For more presentations like this, visit www.xenos.org.
All right, so moving forward in this series that we're calling The Essential Jesus, those of you who've been here know that what we're doing is drawing upon the four eyewitness accounts of Jesus's life in the New Testament, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, and drawing from them to survey the main events in Jesus's life and to survey some of the main elements in his public ministry. For over the last few weeks, we've been focusing on the key elements of Jesus's early public ministry, which took place geographically up here in northern Israel, in that region called Galilee, because the Sea of Galilee was in its center. And we saw that his early ministry was characterized by a couple of really public elements, his preaching and teaching, and also his miraculous healing ministry. But this morning we're going to look at another key aspect of his early public ministry that was done quietly and behind the scenes, namely his calling of his disciples and then the development of those disciples that he called. This was a strategic priority for Jesus from the beginning of his ministry. Of course, on one level, these disciples were unique. Besides the fact that they were unique individuals, he discipled 12 of these people to be his apostles. That is, they would go on to be his official and inspired spokespersons. And so they have a unique role in the church and a unique authority that none of us possesses. On the other hand, Jesus, the living Jesus, is alive today. And the living Jesus calls people to be his disciples today, and he develops those who respond to his call. And in fact, it's clear that he wants every single person to be his disciple. So as we look into this theme, we're going to focus on the principles, some of the principles that undergirded his calling and development of these disciples, because they apply also to each one of us. So we'll just take as our base text a little passage in the first chapter of Mark. We'll come back to this over and over again. It reads like this in Mark 1:14. It says, "Now after John the Baptist had been taken into custody, then Jesus came into Galilee. And as he was going along by the Sea of Galilee, he saw Simon and Andrew, who was the brother of Simon, casting a net into the sea," because they were fishermen. "And Jesus said to them, 'Follow me, and I will make you to become fishers of men,'" or people. "And immediately they left their nets and followed him. Going on a little farther, he saw James, the son of Zebedee, and John, his brother, who were also in the boat mending their nets. Immediately Jesus called them, and they left their father Zebedee in the boat with the hired help and went away to follow him." Well, I just have to tell you that when I was a new Christian reading this passage for the first time, it was deeply shocking and disturbing. Because I just read it with the assumption that this was the initial encounter between Jesus and these men. And can you imagine someone walking up to other people as a total stranger and telling them to follow him, and them, you know, dropping everything, dropping their careers and walking off with this stranger? I have to tell you that I was very conflicted, because I just met Christ personally, but this passage made me feel that there was a really big creep level in him. I'm serious. I mean, what do you call someone who walks up to total strangers and says, you know, "Marry me right now," or whatever? I mean, it's creepy. It's creepy on any one of a number of levels. Furthermore, at that very time, which was at the height of something that later became known as the Jesus movement, there were cult groups that used this very passage to prey on brand new young Christians. I had a friend who had just become a Christian, and this cult group came up to him, met him on the street. These guys who were strangers said, do you believe in Jesus? He said, yeah. They showed him this passage, and they said, get in the van. If you love Jesus, get in the van. He did, and they took him out of town, and we never saw him again for 20 years. That's creepy. That's just creepy. So what are we to make of this? Well, this would be an example of how important it is to understand, read each individual passage in the Bible in light of its larger context. And when we do that with this passage, we discover that this was not the first encounter between Jesus and these men. Rather, this was an important juncture in a relationship that began almost a year and a half earlier. And that changes things. Even Mark gives us a hint about that because he says this was after John the Baptist had been arrested. John the Baptist, we know, was arrested, taken into custody by Herod about a year to a year and a half after Jesus began his public ministry. The interesting thing is that it's only the Gospel of John, the fourth book in the New Testament, that details that first year plus period. The first four chapters of the Gospel of John talk about that period. And that period begins in John 1 with Jesus' initial encounter with these men. I want you to read that with me and note how different this original encounter is from this encounter a year and a half later. It says in John 1, the next day, this is the day after Jesus was baptized and announced to be the Messiah, John the Baptist was standing with two of his disciples. His disciple just means students or apprentices. And he looked at Jesus as he walked and he said, behold, the Lamb of God. He's like, dudes, this is the Messiah that you've been waiting for. The two disciples heard him speak and they followed Jesus. You'll see what that means in just a moment. It means just that. They literally began to walk behind him. It says that Jesus turned and saw them following. And he said to them, what do you seek? And they said, well, Rabbi or teacher, where are you staying? He said to them, well, why don't you come and see? And so they came and saw where he was staying, and they hung out with him that day. Because it was about 2 in the afternoon when they met him. And it says, then one of the two who heard John speak and followed him was Andrew, you know, Simon Peter's brother. Andrew found first his own brother, Simon, and he said to him, I think we've found the Messiah. And so he brought Simon to Jesus, and it says that Jesus looked at him in the course of their conversation and said, yeah, you're Simon. Simon means unstable, means rash, impetuous. He says, that's a good name for you, but you will be called Rock. Peter means the rock. And so that's the initial encounter between Jesus and these guys. How very different. You realize that even in their initial encounter, they started talking with Jesus because other credible people in their lives said, you should get to know this guy. Right? John the Baptist said to two of his disciples, you should get to know him. Andrew said to his brother, I think this guy is someone that's worthy of you meeting. We see that far from challenging them to drop everything and follow him out of town, Jesus simply responds to their request. Could we hang out? By saying, yeah, let's go hang out for an afternoon and talk. That's very different. And we see also that, at least in Peter's case, as they talked, this must have made an impression on him. Jesus seemed to know who Peter was, including his weaknesses, but it was clear that Jesus had a vision for him. He was viewing Peter in terms of what he could become as one who knew Jesus. So when you put all this together, what do you have? What you have is the fact that Jesus' call to them to become his disciples And their response to that call was preceded by them meeting him and getting to know him over about a year to a year and a half period of time. And during that time, they worked at their jobs by day. They'd take little short trips with him. They'd hear him preach and teach. They'd ask him questions. They see his compassion for the hurting and for the outcasts. And so the principle here, I think, is pretty obvious and super important, which is that when it comes to being a disciple of Jesus, that is always preceded by beginning a personal relationship with Jesus. Everyone always laughs at that picture. I think it's hilarious, too. What's it illustrating? What's the maxim? Don't get the cart before the horse. What's the cart? The cart is becoming a disciple of Jesus. What's the horse? That's beginning a relationship with Jesus. A lot of Christians are confused in this point, and therefore they sound a message to non-Christians that's just not true. A lot of Christians believe and communicate, in order to become a Christian, you've got to be a sold-out disciple of Jesus. That's not what Jesus did with these guys. He met them. They formed a friendship with him. And in that context, after a considerable period of time, then he said, let's take this next step. And that's the norm. That's the way it is. For us to reverse this leads to terrible misunderstanding. It really impedes people from coming to Christ. If I had been told that I had to basically radically change my life in order to become a Christian, I would never have done it. And some of the reasons for never doing it were pretty valid, which is, I don't even know who this person is. Right? On the other hand, for Christ to come to me about 2 years into my relationship with him, and I remember where it was, and communicating to me, I want you to basically give me your life. That's a whole different thing, because by then I had learned that he was wise, that he was loving, that he was faithful. And I had a basis for making that decision. Pretty important. That's, you know, this is my favorite verse in the Bible, because this is the verse that brought me to Christ, where he just issues that invitation, the invitation of the horse, right? I stand at the door and knock. If you hear my voice and open the door, then I'll come into your life. And we'll share a meal as friends. The meal is a figure of speech talking about we'll begin to get to know each other. We'll have fellowship with each other. We'll develop a relationship. That comes first. And some of you sitting here this morning, this is the point that you need to hear, because you've been getting the cart before the horse. You've been sizing up how much you're willing to change your life before you meet Christ. Christ says, I want you to meet me. And in that context, invite you to allow me to change your life voluntarily and gradually. All the difference in the world. You say, well, but still, if I receive Christ, my life's probably going to wind up being different than I planned, right? Yeah, it will be. You bet it will be. Of course, your life's going to be different than you plan it, too. And we'll come back to that in just a few minutes. So that's the first principle. So important that we are clear on this. Now let's go back to our passage and dip into it again. We noted that Jesus, it says that when he saw Simon and Andrew, and he spoke to them. So he called them together. He called them as a pair. Of course, he was calling each of them individually, but he called them as a pair. And so likewise with James and John, it says he said called them. And so we note here something that comes up over and over again, that yes, Jesus calls each of us to become his apprentice individually. But he always calls us as his disciples into a community of other disciples. He never calls us to be developed in isolation from other disciples of Christ. And so as you read the way he developed them, he didn't choose 12 of them just for efficiency's sake. Because them being a team or a group led by him was intrinsic to their development. The lessons they learned from him together. The ministry training that they received from him was training in the context of teamwork. The debriefing that they got was as a team. That's intrinsic to the development of discipleship. I think about, you know, passages like this where they name the 12 disciples. We're not going to read all those names. You can read them. But what is fascinating to me is that in some cases, these folks already had pre-existing relationships like James and John, like Andrew and Simon. And yet now, as they became Jesus' disciples, their pre-existing relationships were changed in some pretty powerful ways. But on the other hand, he purposefully brought together 12 persons who were many of whom were very different from each other. And we know that they were different in personality. We know that they came from different backgrounds. We know they came from different parts of Israel. We know that they came from different political backgrounds with different political opinions. And he purposefully brought all of these people together and develop them together with all those differences. And that also is noteworthy. Of course, the principle, as I've already stated, and he makes it clear at the end of his ministry with them, when he said, "A new commandment I give to you, that you love each other the way that I've loved you, that you love each other the same way. By this people will know that I'm real and that you're my followers if you have this kind of love for each other." He made this community, loving community commitment, critical to the purpose of their whole existence. He's like, this is the way that the mission is going to get accomplished. So the principle is obvious that when it comes to responding to Christ's call for you to be his, will you be his disciple? Will you follow him? We need to understand that this responding to this call involves being in community with other disciples of Jesus. There's really no give in the Bible on this. I think there are certain extreme exceptions. For example, if after receiving Christ, you were wrongfully arrested and committed to lifelong solitary confinement, that would be an exception. But I don't know that there's, you know, that and things like that. This is how it happens. And this is why we say that for you to be a believer in Christ and for you to want to develop in your relationship with Christ without a willingness to get involved with other Christ followers, it won't happen. Your development will be so primitive. Your development will be so arrested. You are sentencing yourself to perpetual immaturity and spiritual dissatisfaction. That's just what the Bible teaches. And of course, why am I ranting about this? Because here we are in direct collision, not only with the values of our 21st century American culture, but with the values of most of the 21st century American evangelical church, which conceives of discipleship as mainly just Jesus and me, with occasional interactions with large groups of Christians in a don't ask, don't tell culture. And then we wonder why the church is so impotent in this culture. It will never work. We live in a culture that prizes autonomous individualism. Autonomous means my will is the most important. Auto means self. Nomos means will or law. I am a law unto myself. You're not the boss of me. It's funny how popular that phrase is, how many people resonate with it. I'm the boss of me. And individualism means that My own rights, my own freedoms, my own self-direction is the axis around which I want my circumstances and relationships to orbit. And you can't square that with Christian discipleship. It has to be rejected as a value. Many years ago, I read this quote from a Chinese Christian leader named Watchman Nee, and I remember it well because it tore through me like a sword. But I did this last time too. So the point is, that's why all of these metaphors for the church in the New Testament are metaphors that emphasize teamwork and community, the family, the temple in which we're mortared next to each other, the army in formation, and of course the body, the human body of interdependent organs. Nee says, alone, I cannot serve the Lord effectively. And he will spare no pains to teach me this. This is the very opposite of humans' condition by nature, which is essentially individualistic. See, according to God, autonomous individualism is our deepest problem. It's not a virtue to celebrate. As a Christian, I may have gotten over some specific sin problems and yet still be a confirmed individualist. Oh, how true that often is. And so God must therefore deal with me on this matter, or I will remain in conflict with his ends. God does not blame me for being an individual. God made us as individuals. He celebrates that. He blames me for my individualism. When I see this, then I will be done with independence and I will seek fellowship. That's the sentence that tore into me. If I see this, then I need to be done with independence and seek fellowship. The life of Christ in me will gravitate toward the life of Christ in others, and I can no longer take the individualistic line. And so many of us find, as I myself experience, that after receiving Christ, there comes a point where Christ confronts us about our autonomous individualism and calls on us to take our place in community. I remember that decision as clearly as I remember the decision to receive Christ about 2 years later, arguing with him over this point, complaining about my disappointment with my spiritual life, and him speaking to me, not audibly, but speaking to me really in a way even more clearly, like, why are you tying my hands? Why are you preventing me from helping you to grow and develop? You refuse to really engage with my people in a genuine and vulnerable way. And with that came a couple of very specific things that he wanted me to do. One, he wanted me to go to one of my few Christian friends and just sit down and tell him the mess that I felt my life was, which I'd never done under any circumstances with anyone ever in my life. And two, he showed me right after I did that he wanted me to be willing to pray out loud with a small group of Christians after a Bible study. I remember sitting there and sensing, you're supposed to pray. I don't know what to say. I don't think to this day anyone who was there understood what I said. But it was important for me to throw in that way and to admit I'm a fellow stumbling follower of Jesus and I want to talk to him. Something broke loose deep within me at that time. And some of you are in a state of arrested development spiritually for this reason. That, you know, it's like, I'm going to do this with Jesus. Well, good. Jesus is going to have you do it with us. And so, if God is speaking to you on this, just simply take it up with him today and say, I think you're calling me out on this. I think you're right. I feel stuck here. I feel scared here. I feel cynical here. What is it that, but I'm willing to hear from you. What is it that you would like me to do here? And he will show you a step that is doable with him And you would be amazed at how that may change the whole vitality of your relationship with Him. Now, there's a third principle in this same passage that tempers. It's not in contradiction to the one we just covered. It tempers it. You remember, in the middle of that passage, Jesus said to Andrew and Simon, "Follow me, and I will make you." That means, that doesn't mean at gunpoint I'll force you. It means I will develop you into fishers of people. So they were fishermen. They knew what fishing was about. It was about gathering fish into the boat. And so he speaks to them in their language and says, yeah, follow me and I'll develop you for a similar but different mission. Our mission will be gathering people. All metaphors are limited. And so also is this one. When I think of, you know, I went bass fishing in Canada in July. And what did we do there? We seduced and deceived fish. And then we hooked them against their will with a sharp object. We dragged them into the boat. We put them on a chain. And then we took them home and cut them and ate them. The metaphor is limited. Right? Jesus said in Luke 19, the Son of Man has come to seek and to save that which is lost. So the fishing here is the commitment to initiate with and to reach out to and to hopefully influence people to come to Christ and be rescued from their lostness. It's not to seduce them and cut them and eat them. Right? But it is a gathering. It is an intentional initiative and gathering. It's the mission of Christ. And so you see that right, even as he calls them into much closer community with each other, he's also saying, and in that community context, I'm going to develop you to go out beyond our community. People often feel these are contradictory. They are not. They're absolutely complementary. You see it in one verse. Jesus appointed the 12 disciples. Why? Two purpose clauses. So that they would be with him, in community with him, and so that he would send them out to preach, to proclaim to others. They go together. So the principle is clear that to be respond to Jesus' call to be his disciple involves learning from him how to gather other people, to influence other people toward his kingdom. That is critical. If you take these two principles, that discipleship to Jesus involves community with his people, and discipleship to Jesus involves influencing people who don't know him to come to him, if you don't hold them together, the result is disastrous either way. I run into Christians all the time who are fully committed to the mission to reach the lost, but who don't even have close Christian peer friendship, and it's only a matter of time before they either go bizarre or burn out. I've seen it for 4 decades. On the other hand, if you have a group that's committed to being a cozy, warm, loving, holy huddle that does not have the mission to reach out to lost people, that holy huddle becomes a dysfunctional, imploding mess. And I've seen that for 40 years. What if Peter had said, Jesus, okay, I'll be your disciple, but here's my plan, Jesus, for you. You can be our life coach, economic advisor, master fisherman, and we'll build a great fish catching business, and then we'll all retire together on some villa on the Mediterranean. We'll just be happy and love each other. It's just like, no way. That's not what this is about. Right at the heart of this principle here, that Jesus Christ, after we meet him and we develop a relationship with him, He calls us to let Him build our lives around His mission for our lives. And that is what a lot of American Christians stumble over. It's like, no, I want Jesus to be my genie. I want Him to be the one who helps me facilitate my agenda for my life. And that is a tussling point. That's a point where all of us sometimes have a controversy with Him over this, and some of us are stuck in that controversy. I like the way Paul says to the Philippians, if you read the letter to the Philippians, the whole first chapter and a half of his letter is on them, urging them to become a more loving community together. And then he says, and live in such a way that you prove yourselves to be children of God above reproach in the midst of a crooked and perverse generation, among whom you appear as lights in the world, holding forth the word of life. Don't you love that image? I want you to live before your neighbors, before your business associates, before your non-Christian family. Every social role you have, I want you to live in a way that doesn't reproach the name of Christ, where people see something positively different about you. And I want you to hold forth the message about Christ to those people. That's the end of verse 16 that hits me. Paul says, I'm urging you to do that, so that in the day of Christ, I will have reason to glory, because I didn't run in vain or toil in vain. What is he saying? This man who sacrificed so much to help these people come to Christ and to form them into a Christian community, he's saying, if you don't grow up to be people who represent Christ to lost people effectively, my work was in vain. That gives you some sense of how important this priority is in Christian discipleship. We had a celebration two nights ago right in this room to kind of celebrate. Part of it was to celebrate and give glory to God for some of the many things He's done through our little part of His church in spite of our screwed upness over the last year. The part that was most exciting to me was to have Mike Sullivan kind of survey all the different ways that so many hundreds of people in these 25 home churches are doing this. Not only reaching out to neighbors and family members and friends, but people hosting high school home churches that enables so many high school kids to help their friends come to Christ, making meals for Renegade Bible studies and other inner city youth Bible studies, people working with folks who are in addiction, people who are working with family members of people struggling with addiction, people serving at the clinics that we have here so that people come and get their physical needs met and hear about Christ. You see, that's the thing. Jesus doesn't develop us into cookie-cutter fishermen. He has uniquely placed you among people who don't know Him. None of it's by accident. And He's uniquely gifted you or strengthened you in various ways to be involved in this work in ways that are unique and significant. It is for us to embrace this mission and say, however you want to use me in gathering people to you. That's what I want to do. Rick Warren puts it this way. You have a choice to make. He calls it, you will either be a world-class Christian or a worldly Christian. You could replace this with, you could either be a Christian who's a disciple of Christ or not. You can be a Christian who's not a disciple of Christ. Worldly Christians look to God primarily for personal fulfillment. They are saved, but they are self-centered. It's got a way with words, no mincing words here. Their prayers focus on their own needs, their own blessings, their own happiness. It's a me-first faith, how can God make my life more comfortable? Indeed, almost all of us come to Christ with this mentality, right? And that's the beautiful. He meets us right there. They want to use God for their purposes instead of being used for his purposes. In contrast, those who have responded to his call to discipleship know that they are saved in order to serve and made for a mission. They're eager to receive a personal assignment and excited about the privilege of being used by God. Boy, used by anyone is a dirty word in our culture, because it's usually bad when a person uses you. But not when the God of who made you uses you. That's where real fulfillment is. World-class Christians are the only fully alive people on the planet. Boy, that's quite a statement there. Their joy, their confidence, their enthusiasm are contagious because they know they're making a difference. They wake up each morning expecting God to work through them in fresh ways. Which type of Christian do you want to be? That's a great question. Which type of Christian do you want? I know what I want. I do not. Even before I met Christ, I always feared being bored. That was my first crisis of faith after I met Christ, is what am I going to do for all eternity? And it took a while to resolve that. But, you play it safe and live for self. You're just going to wind up bored. Bored and miserable. This is when Jesus said, I've come that you might have life and have it abundantly, when he said, I'm saying these things to you so that you may have my joy in you and that your joy may be made full. The context of those statements was following me into my mission. Well, that brings us to the last principle in our passage. We'll circle back around to it. You are familiar with it by now. And of course, we circle all the way around to what it began as the creep factor in Jesus. And after we understand how that's not that way, yet still it's clear that when he issued his call for them to be his disciples and they said yes, he said, I want you to change jobs. Right? That's undeniable. They left their nets. And then again, they left their father Zebedee in the boat. Let's think about this from Zebedee's standpoint. It's like, hey, what happened? Jesus didn't ask Zebedee permission. He didn't apologize to Zebedee. These were grown men. And he's like, let's go. In their case, it was mandatory that they leave their vocation and be trained by him full time for over 3 years. That's not the norm. The Bible's very clear that most of us are to stay right where we are vocationally and be his disciples there. But don't miss the principle. This was massively disruptive to their lives. It was undoubtedly was a step of risk, a step of trust. And he called them to take it unambiguously. Imagine if Andrew said, how about if I be your disciple, but just keep fishing? What would Jesus have said? No, that's not my plan for you. See? And indeed, this was the first of many, many disruptions to their lives over the next 3 years. It's like, then he starts saying, let's go over and camp out in this part of the Mideast that you've never been to and that you don't like. And then it's like, well, let's go meet and talk to these people that are different ethnically from you that you've been taught to hate. And at times he would administer to them a very clear rebuke for their racism or for their self-centeredness. Then at other times he'd throw them right in over their head in a ministry situation so that they had to learn how to trust him. If you read those 3 years through that lens, it's disruption after disruption after disruption. And this explains why the size, the number of Jesus's disciples over those 3 years kept shrinking. We all think, oh, it just got bigger and bigger and bigger. No, it got smaller and smaller and smaller. Because it's like, I don't know. I'm tired of the disruptions. Here's an example. About 2.5 years in, he gives this one talk that really bothers his disciples. Many of his disciples, when they heard this, said, this is a difficult statement. Who can listen to this? And as a result of this, many of his disciples withdrew and were not walking with him anymore. And so Jesus said to the 12, will you please stay? I won't say anything more that's difficult. He did not say that. He said, you don't want to go away also, do you? And that is a rhetorical question. The meaning of it is, do you want to leave too? You can leave if you want to. He didn't say it dismissively. He didn't say it with scorn. You wimps, get out of here. He reminded them that their discipleship to him was always voluntary. He was saying, I don't draft anyone as my disciples. You have to freely respond. And at each Y in the road, you have the freedom to opt out if you want to. Very important that we remember that. Peter, in a rare moment of insight when he wasn't putting his foot in his mouth, said, Lord, to whom shall we go? I've been down that path before. You alone, that's the sense of it, you alone have words of eternal life. My life has meaning when I'm following you. That's where I'm going to go. And that's the right answer. That's the right answer. So the principle is that obvious, that responding to Jesus' call to be his disciple means following him even when, not if, even when he disrupts your life. You say, is he really going to disrupt? Oh, he's going to disrupt it massively. And he'll never ask your permission before he disrupts it. He'll never apologize to you after he disrupts it. And he'll always give you the choice about whether or not you want to keep following him. So here's, you know, when it comes to the way you relate to people, the relationships that you have, the way you view your job, possibly the job you have, the way you relate to your spouse and your family members, I mean, the way that you respond to adversities that he allows into your life to mold you and shape you, it's just all of these things. He says, I'm the teacher and I'm sovereignly working through all of these things to fashion you. And the thing that I want you to learn, he keeps saying, is I want you to deepen your trust in me to control your life instead of you controlling your life. Because after all, I'm God, and I'm the one who died for your sins, and I'm the one who knows you better than you know yourself, and I'm the one who's more committed to your true well-being than even you are. And this is real. And this is why, as we go on with Christ, those of us who have met him, that we will realize, indeed, there have been times when I've said no. And this is why, if we go on long enough, we will see many who were disciples of Christ, that number shrinking at times. Many years ago, I read this quote, very insightful. This guy, Christopher Adds, it said, a disciple is a person in process. The process begins when a person receives Christ, and it will continue as long as that person keeps learning, because a disciple is a learner, an apprentice. A disciple, therefore, will never arrive, because the Lord will continue to expose areas where he wants to bring about deeper commitments to him and more profound changes. From time to time in this process, he will up the ante for his learners. To the growing disciple, he'll say, you've been doing well. But now it's time to graduate to the next class. More will be expected now. Are you willing to accept this new challenge? If the disciple says yes, then he continues to learn. He continues to grow. He continues to be used in the work of the kingdom. He continues to be a disciple of Jesus. But if he's not willing to go on, Jesus says, then you can't be my disciple. Your eternal destiny is by no means in jeopardy. You can change your mind at any time and will resume class. But as long as you maintain that stance, you are not my learner. That being the case, you'll find that most younger Christians are disciples. I love this. Because they have such an intense drive to learn more about their relationship with God, and because they haven't had much opportunity to bail out yet. That's really true. It really is. The zeal of a newer Christian to grow and serve God is wonderful, and we should praise God for it, and we should always ask God for that. And it's also true that they've had very few whys in the road. Yeah. On the other hand, you may find someone who's been pastoring a large church for 25 years, has a seminary doctorate, has memorized half the Bible, and led hundreds to the Lord, and yet is not a disciple currently. Because there came a time when he said, no, I'm not willing to go any further. I'm not willing to make that sacrifice. I'm not interested in any more learning. And to him, Jesus has said, then you can't be my disciple. I'm ready to resume class with you anytime. Very, very true. Very true. And the point that I want to make here on this is why would a follower of Jesus ever at one of these whys decide to drop the class? It's got to be only because somehow we believe that staying in class is going to wind up messing us up. It's got to be because we believe getting out of class with Jesus is going to make us happier. And it is exactly the opposite. Always. It's always exactly the opposite. If you've been out of class with Jesus for a while, then you know how boring and stagnant that life is. And you also know if you stay in class, even through the whys in the road, how exciting and personally fulfilling that way of life is. But each time, it's like we have to decide who we trust all over again. It's healthy. That's what I got. Those four principles related to being Jesus' disciples. We'll discuss this in just a moment. Next week, we're going to cover a unique event in Jesus's ministry, a private event between him and a few of his disciples called, we call it the Transfiguration, a deep passage. And yeah, so come back and study that with us.
This study was recorded at Xenos Christian Fellowship and is copyrighted. You may freely copy and distribute it as long as you keep it intact and do not sell it.